Welcome to Tokyo Game Life, a Tokyo-based video game podcast focusing on Nintendo and gaming culture in Japan's capital. Your host Mono here. Finally, it's really starting to feel like spring in Japan. Some people might argue against this, but to me it feels like Tokyo has 6 months of winter and 6 months of summer, with a few brief moments of spring and fall in there. So you really got to enjoy spring while it lasts. You got to get your fill of sakura mochi, sakura lattes, sakura tacos. Yes, those do exist. This year is speeding by. So let's talk about racing games. Was that a good transition? I don't think it was that bad. You got to work with what you have. This episode's feature is all on DDR Akiba, which is self-described as a racing simulator pro shop. Here you can experience high-tech virtual racing using authentic steering wheels and equipment, plus get trained by professional drivers. It's the closest you'll come to racing down a real speedway in Japan. And no, it has nothing to do with Dance Dance Revolution. But hey, that would be pretty fun to talk about in the future too. On the games front, we're putting the pedal to the metal and talking about three big racing releases. Okay, let's be honest. Two are big and one is at least interesting. I'll give my thoughts on the first wave of Mario Kart 8 Deluxe's Booster Course Pass. Do the first new Mario Kart 8 tracks in years live up to the hype? Nintendo also recently released F-Zero X on Nintendo Switch Online. It's the first time I've really spent time with the title, so I really wanted to weigh in a mere 24 years after its release. And we're going even more old school with Stunt Race FX, another Nintendo Switch Online title with a cult following. Did you know that Miyamoto worked on this game? It's no Mole Mania, but there's a lot to talk about. Now, I know some of you might be thinking, where's Kirby? Normally, if a big game releases on Friday, I talk about it if there's an episode planned for Sunday. However, I'm recording this episode early for reasons, and it'll be finished before Kirby comes out. So I'm going to go all in on Kirby next episode. Anyways, let's move right into our feature on Driving Simulator Pro Shop DDR Akiba. Put your racing gloves on because this week's feature is about DDR Akiba, self-described as a racing simulator pro shop. That sounds quite fancy, but really it's an arcade that focuses on driving simulators. If you want something a bit more Gran Turismo and less Mario Kart, this shop has you covered. Even though it focuses on more realistic and authentic racing, novices are more than welcome. The shop is called DDR, and the English says Dare Demo Racer. I assume this is supposed to mean Dare Demo, which means anyone in Japanese, so yes, anyone can come and have a competitive racing experience. Have they never been sued by the Dance Dance Revolution people? Maybe it's a live and let live type of situation. I tried to find out about the history of the store, but not a lot is written about it online. Most of the signatures on the wall are from 2014, so it's been around at least since that time. And as you can guess from the name, it's in Akihabara, about a 5-minute walk from the station. Akihabara, of course, is the nexus of otaku culture. At least men's otaku culture. The girls have Ikebukuro on lock. Anime, manga, video game, toys, it's got everything. It's a tourist hotspot, and if you're visiting Tokyo, you'll undoubtedly check it out. I don't want to be a snobby, actually I live here and Akiba is bad type of person, since I do think Akiba is certainly worth visiting, but it can definitely be overwhelming and hard to parse, and more expensive than expected. If you live in Tokyo and are a retro game collector, for example, you probably aren't visiting Akiba to throw down cash, since there are many cheaper options like Book Off or online shopping. And if you're only looking for one specific nerdy thing, again like video games, you gotta wade through all the anime, toys, and maids to get there. Akiba is definitely a great place to visit and take pictures of, though, and there are many hidden gems in very specific shops you won't find anywhere else. DDR Akiba is one of them. It's actually located above a hard-off, which is something I covered on this podcast. You gotta love the synergy here. It's humbly located in a small room on the fifth floor of a random building. You gotta love how people utilize these very dull spaces in amazing ways. This room could have been used for anything. It wasn't built for a racing simulator pro shop, but someone decided to have a realistic racing arcade here. It has a small neon sign above the door, which, again, is just a normal looking door. Now, what's inside? You'll likely notice the three racing setups they have on the right side of the store. Each one is equipped with a racing seat with a steering wheel and transmission surrounded by three huge TVs. One of the racing areas has smaller computer monitors, though, if you feel like you might get sick or overwhelmed by the visuals. But it looks like they've ripped out the innards of a race car and put them into the store. Outside of the racing pods, the store is covered with racing posters, celebrity signatures, and trophies. They're really using every inch of the store here. You get a sense that the store is run by hardcore racing fans, which, you know, you'd hope so. The shop also advertises driving lessons from professional drivers, but you do need to reserve in advance and poke around to see what times they are available. I assume they would just have somebody there on call to give lessons, but it seems like they really only come via appointments. Before you can jump inside a virtual car, though, you'll need to buy a ticket. They have a typical Japanese-style ticket machine. Think of a ramen ticket vendor, but you really don't need to use it. Especially if it's your first time. You can just talk to the clerk and say what plan you want. Now, you pay for a certain block of time, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes. You can also pay for extra services, like competitive races where you and someone else are on the same track, or even a data logger where you can analyze your race performance. I went with my wife, so we got 30 minutes each, and of course, we raced against each other. 30 minutes is 3,000 yen, plus you'll need to rent driving gloves, so it can be 3,500 yen, or about $30 per person. That is a bit pricey for something that you really only do for half an hour, but it is a unique experience that you likely can't do anywhere else in Tokyo. Honestly, maybe 30 minutes is a bit too long. Don't be afraid to do only 10 or 20 minutes. Oh, and you have to rent racing gloves, which is an extra 500 yen. I noticed someone brought their own gloves, so there are definitely some hardcore fans of this place. Now, the prices are different for members and non-members. So much so that, yeah, you'll want to be a member. Sign up is easy, though. Just fill out some basic info on an iPad. You can lie about your phone number and email. They won't check. You also get a member card for your trouble, so think of it as a nice souvenir. The shop was unexpectedly crowded. There were about three people ahead of me, and three people came in right after I did. I was honestly expecting my wife and I to be the only people there. Turns out this hobby is far more popular than I imagined. Fortunately, there are a lot of chairs and couches to lounge around in while you wait. They also have a TV set up to watch real races. More importantly, there are booklets detailing the cars and tracks available. Now, I am not a car junkie, so I didn't have anything in particular I wanted to pick, but I did want to choose a Japanese car, of which there are many. And I picked the Fuji Raceway, even though Fuji is actually quite a bit of ways away from the track. My wife didn't share my sentiment and went straight for the Lamborghini. Since we were beginners and there were quite a lot of people there, the staff recommended we do 15 minutes separate to get a feel of the equipment, then take a break and race against each other for the last 15 minutes. This is not exactly what we paid for, but honestly, I think this format is perfect. At first, you're likely to have no idea what you're doing, so you need some time to figure out the feel of the equipment. Also, since there is a break period, you can switch your car out, which both of us did. Typically, one 30-minute session is one track, one car, so I'm glad we could try multiple cars out. Before you hop in, you tell the staff what car and track you want. Now, unless you have everything perfectly memorized, it's definitely a long-winded question and answer session. I asked a staff member to recommend a Japanese car, but then he followed up with what brand. I don't know, I thought you were supposed to recommend it. I said Subaru, because I saw a cool Subaru race car in the booklet, but I didn't remember the exact model, so I just went with his recommendation. He picked one that is apparently in Fast and Furious, but it doesn't look like it. The car I ended up with pretty much just looks like a regular car. It wasn't any special fancy race car. My wife went straight for the high-speed Lambo, which is an obvious choice for many, but I wanted the authentic feeling of driving a Japanese car down a Japanese raceway. Once everything is set up, you'll hop right into the racing seat. It's elevated quite a bit off the ground, and the actual seat is quite narrow. If you are on the heftier side, you might have some trouble wedging in here. Along with the seat is the steering wheel, pedals, stick shift, and a bunch of other gauges. You really don't need to choose anything from the menus. The staff handles everything for you. It's up to you to just drive. Now, of course, I asked the staff the most important question. What game is this? You can see a menu and yeah, it looks like a normal game and not some sort of specially made racing simulator for professionals. He answered Assetto Corsa, which is an Italian-made racing game that came out in 2014, and the sequel came out in 2021. So if you really want to dumb it down, the entire place is just a chance to play Assetto Corsa in a racing seat. Which may sound silly, but it works. I mean, there are plenty of other racing sims out there, so why not use one? It's just a bit funny to think, oh, I could just buy this game. A new Assetto Corsa came out last year, but I am pretty sure this is the original game. It's about 8 years old, so it's not exactly a looker compared to something like GT7. The three widescreen TVs certainly help you feel immersed, though. The staff will ask you about a bunch of options you want on or off. I wanted to at least try manual, so I stuck with that. Now, the steering wheel has a bunch of buttons that do things. Honestly, I didn't really need to press them, and I noticed that most people didn't use them either. I assume the buttons are really just for the hardest of the hardcore. So I got in my Subaru and raced around Fuji. If you have trouble, the staff will pop in to help you. They really don't teach you anything, though, but they will at least help you understand, hey, why is my car not moving? When you're actually driving, it does feel immersive and you get lost in the experience. It's not quite VR because there's no headset, but it's close enough. Needless to say, it's in first person, and you'll be glancing at the other TVs to check your side mirrors and other data. It's still a game, so the minimap is on the screen, which helps nail some tough turns. Now, I have driven a car before, but never manual. So I had some trouble figuring out how to gear shift, but the staff helped me out, and the game does make it clear when you should shift your gear up. The chair is equipped with hydraulics, I guess. It moves, it vibrates, it feels like you're really in the car. It's almost like 4DX if you've ever done that. You definitely might be a bit sore afterwards. I saw people literally sweating after a 30-minute session. Not sure if that's the seat or the game gets their blood pumping. It's a bit hot inside the room considering it's small and has about 8 or so people, along with these gigantic race pods. Back to the actual race, you're likely to crash. But it's no big deal. The staff doesn't get mad and the game doesn't really punish you for missing a turn or hurling yourself into a wall. Eventually, I did get a feel about how to shift gears, how to make a turn correctly. My first session was only 15 minutes, but I felt that I improved in that short time frame. After 15 minutes, we took a break. My wife was pretty much spent. She picked a very fast and intense car. I'm not sure if Lamborghinis are a good beginner car. Some other customers raced while we waited, and it was interesting to observe them. One guy was in an F1 car and was blasting through these tight corners at 250 kilometers per hour. It was impressive how quickly he shifted gears and managed to hit those turns perfectly. I can't say it watching him helped me improve, but it was fun to watch. After a 30-minute break period, we hopped back into the pods. I changed my car to a Nissan GT-R 3.5, which looks like a real race car. My wife chose a more beginner-friendly car, according to the staff. I was ready. Ready to become a real racer. I gotta admit, though, I went automatic this time. I just wanted to chill and drive and not worry about stick management. My wife is more hardcore than me, and she chose pedal changing, where you shift gears via these pedals on the steering wheel. Now, this was an actual competitive race, so we could see each other on the course. This was a ton of fun, especially when the other car suddenly starts spinning out of control right before your eyes. She still had trouble with staying on the track, but switching to auto helped me out a lot. Still missed some turns, still crashed into a wall, but not as much. Every time the gear automatically shifted, I felt a kick in my chair, so that was a fun signifier. In the last few minutes, I caught up with my wife and we started to race a bit more closely. It's a lot of fun to see the other racer next to you, although she did violently ram me in the final seconds and spin my car out of control. Pretty sure that's not allowed in real racing. We didn't get any real result, but I'm pretty sure I was in the lead since I lapped her twice. Even though she still had trouble controlling her car, she thought it was a lot of fun, and there's a novelty to actually seeing other racers on the course instead of just time attack. DDR Akiba is really a unique place and exemplifies what I love about Tokyo. If you can think it, you can do it. I only found this place because the games I planned to cover this episode were all racing themed, so surely there must be some VR racing place in Tokyo. And yeah, there is. Of course, it's Tokyo. If you're a hardcore racing sim fan or an Assetto Corsa fan, I think you'll definitely have a great time. Even complete car newbies like myself should enjoy the tactile feeling of being in a quote-unquote actual race car. The price might turn some people off. It's pretty much 100 yen a minute with extras, but it's an experience you'll likely not find anywhere else. DDR Akiba, check it out if you're in the area. Now on to more racing game talk. Mario Kart 8 Booster Course Pass, Wave 1 of seemingly infinite waves, hit a few days ago. When Mario Kart 8 came out in 2014 on the Wii U, I don't think many expected that there would be news about it in 2022. Even though the Wii U was only around for about 18 months at that time, the writing was already on the wall and nothing could save the console. There was also that infamous Polygon article about it being the lowest-selling Mario Kart, which of course is very funny to look back on. Even though it released on a DOA console, Mario Kart 8 was a huge hit, critically and financially. It easily became the best-selling game on the Wii U, and many were saying it was the best Mario Kart yet, myself included. The tight controls, the variety of tracks, and an improved implementation of the part system quickly made it my favorite Mario Kart game. Mario Kart is a bit like Pokemon in that the first game definitely has a strong emotional resonance. The first one you played is always your favorite, they say. I don't think this is necessarily true for either franchise, but it definitely becomes the bar in which all other entries in the franchise are judged against. For me, my first Mario Kart was Mario Kart 64, but that game has been topped several times in my opinion. I like Mario Kart DS and Mario Kart Wii more than Mario Kart 64, for instance. But I'm sorry, 64 is better than Double Dash. I know some people evangelize Double Dash, but I'm not one of them. Now, if you didn't immediately turn off the podcast, let's stay a bit and talk more about Mario Kart 8's history before jumping into the new tracks. In November of 2014, Mario Kart 8 got the first batch of DLC ever for the franchise, a crossover with Zelda that included Link, 8 tracks including a Hyrule and F-Zero track, and most importantly, alternate Yoshi colors. I was a Yoshi main in Mario Kart 8 Wii U, so colors? I would have paid just for that. These tracks were all stellar, especially the reimaginings of the F-Zero tracks into Mario Kart. It seems like it shouldn't work, but it absolutely does. The Excitebike track was also a great translation of the series into Mario Kart. Plus, that theme. A few months later, we got an Animal Crossing crossover with another batch of excellent tracks, including the masterpiece Baby Park. Best thing from Double Dash, easily. Funnily enough, this may be the only time I've seen something get pushed up from its original release date. It came out a few weeks before the original launch date. Nintendo was really trying everything in those Wii U days to get people interested. Essentially, we got two really incredible batches of DLC content at an affordable price. A few years later, Mario Kart 8 Deluxe was an early Switch title. No new tracks, but we got a battle mode, new characters, and some gameplay additions like two items and the pink sparks. Plus, there was an incredible novelty to playing a game like Mario Kart 8, one of incredible speed and impressive fidelity as a handheld game. It became an immediate hit and now sells millions every quarter. It is the best-selling Mario Kart SKU, the best-selling Switch game. It's a miraculous game in terms of how much hardware it pushes, and it's incredibly ironic that it started on Nintendo's most ignored console. Considering the Switch's huge success, and that Mario Kart 8 keeps selling, so many people wanted additional Mario Kart 8 DLC. The original DLC content was so good, so why not have more? For me, I felt Deluxe was already complete. Instead of new content, I would have preferred the Mario Kart team to work on a new franchise or spend that effort on MK9. And with Mario Kart 8 selling so well, there really isn't a need for a new Mario Kart on Switch. So if you're Nintendo, what do you do until then? I'm sure the Mario Kart team isn't spinning its wheels. They're working on Mario Kart 9. But the real trigger for Mario Kart 8 DLC is clearly Nintendo wanting to push their online service. Like Happy Home Paradise, the Mario Kart 8 Booster Course Pass is included if you have the expansion pack of Nintendo Switch Online. Man, that's a lot of marketing jargon thrown around. It's Wave 1 of 6 and includes 8 courses. Unlike the original DLC, all these will be remixed courses, so no new tracks. We got Paris Promenade, Tokyo Tour, and Ninja Hideaway from Mario Kart Tour, the mobile game. Shroom Ridge from DS, Toad Circuit from 3DS, Choco Mountain from N64, Sky Garden from GBA, and Coconut Mall from Wii. I've never touched Tour, so these are the most interesting tracks to me. They're practically brand new. You know how it will label remade courses with the original console it debuted on? Like Baby Park has GCN? All these have it as well, except for Ninja Hideaway, despite it originating from Tour. I'm not sure if this is a glitch, but it bugs me. Well, since we're all here, let's break it down track by track. The first set of tracks is the Golden Dash course. Honestly, these course names don't really mean anything, so it's not worth looking into a deeper meaning. The first track is Paris Promenade from Tour. It's a Mario-fied Paris at sunset, complete with famous landmarks like Napoleon's Palace, the Egyptian Obelisk, Arc de Triomphe, and many others. I have been to Paris, so I do remember most of these places. The track's gimmick is that the last lap reverses the course. This is a pretty interesting idea, and I haven't really seen it in any other track. Apparently, these tour tracks are not just HD versions of the mobile courses, but kind of remixes that combines elements of the multiple Paris tracks. I have never touched Tour, so I wish I could shed more light on it, but for me, it's great because it's as if they've made a brand new course. There are some memorable segments, like ramping under the Eiffel Tower or dodging the big piranha plant fountain. The standout element is the reverse track on the last lap, though. Next up is Toad Circuit from Mario Kart 7. This is a very standard, I don't know, racetrack course? I'm not quite sure what you call these types of courses, but they are your very bland, beginner-friendly tracks that are just, well, racing tracks. You don't drive under the sea or in space. It's just a racetrack with spectators. These courses are pretty boring visually, but some of them have good designs. I like Mario Kart Circuit GBA. This track, though, I'm pretty comfortable in saying it's the weakest in the batch. I'm also not a big Mario Kart 7 fan. The game didn't have as much content as I would have liked, and the controls just felt off. Mario Kart DS was my favorite Mario Kart back in the day. Then it was topped by Wii, so I expected big things for 7, but I found it incredibly underwhelming. The gap in quality between 7 and 8 is astronomical. But this is not a rag on Mario Kart 7 segment. I don't think this track is bad, but I just thought, okay, it's just a very by-the-numbers racetrack. The third track is Choco Mountain from 64. Choco, you can say whatever you want. Mario Kart 64 was my first Mario Kart, and this was one of my favorite tracks in that game, so there is a big nostalgia factor at play. The first thing most people notice is that it's quite different visually. It doesn't look as dark, and there are some fun touches like fossils in the walls. The falling boulders now actually have detail instead of being just a brown block. There are some edits, like removing the ramps in a section, but otherwise it's completely faithful to the original. I think a lot of people actually dislike this track, but I'm a big fan of its design and obstacles. The remix soundtrack is great. It has more of a country western vibe that implements guitars. It's a solid, if not safe, remix of this classic N64 track. The final course of this cup is the iconic Coconut Mall from Wii. I think everyone loves this track, but I always had some problems with it. The escalators and ramming cars were more frustrating than fun, but guess what? They fixed both of these. The escalators now have these big green and red arrow ramps, so you can get a better sense of what direction they're going in. Mario Kart 7 also had the arrows in their version of this track, but it's more clear here. The cars are still here, but they don't move. This is obviously a better addition, but I did psych myself out a few times because I did expect them to move. It's still fun to blow past them with a star, too. No means, though, Shy Guys are behind the wheel now. Since those two issues were fixed, I think this track is better than ever and still holds up to even more modern, elaborately designed courses. It has some great alternate routes, some fun segments like ramping up the palm trees and the fountain, plus that last segment with the cars is always chaos and people are trying to get the edge at the very end. The updated visuals look very clean. Some have noted that the booster course passes aren't as strong visually, but I think they are going for a more Mario-ish graphics instead of the more photorealistic touches they used in the other Mario Kart 8 courses. Since all of these courses are remakes, I guess they wanted to preserve the feeling and style of the original course without drastically overhauling it. The next cup is the Lucky Cat Cup, which starts off with Tokyo Blur from Tour. I think you can probably predict my opinion. This is easily my favorite track in this update. It's surreal to see places I've visited in real life now in Mario Kart. They've really crammed in a ton of landmarks. You blast by Kabukiza, Tokyo's biggest kabuki theater, seconds into the match. You also race under Sensoji's iconic Kaminarimon, with the huge lantern, and the track starts on Tokyo's Rainbow Bridge. There are also a lot of background elements that a lot of people might not catch unless they've been to Tokyo. Of course, Tokyo Tower and Skytree loom, but there's also the Asahi Beer Hall, Fuji TV's headquarters, the Tokyo Metropolitan Government Building, and many other landmarks. Even small stuff like a Mario version of Big Camera is really eye-catching. And even if it didn't have all these Tokyo trappings, I still think it would be a good course. All three laps are actually different in their layout, so although it's not quite something like Mount Wario, it still has that same feeling. These tour tracks have easily become my most anticipated since they're implemented into MKA in new ways. I'd love for more specific versions of Tokyo tracks, like a Shinjuku track or a Ginza track. There's more than enough landmarks to play with. The second track is Shroom Ridge from DS. This track is known for its tight turns and lack of railing. A new addition that they've added is the surfboard ramp cars from Toad's Turnpike. This definitely spices things up a bit. Can anyone deny the urge to drive up that surfboard? Shroom Ridge hasn't appeared in any other Mario Kart game since the DS, and to be honest, I pretty much forgot about it. It's a solid track, but Toad's Turnpike will always be the GOAT highway track. Next up is Sky Garden from Super Circuit. Now, while I don't remember Shroom Ridge, I vividly remember Sky Garden. It was one of my favorite tracks in the GBA Mario Kart. It had a cool visual gimmick where you race through the clouds, and it was a challenging yet fair course. The Mario Kart 8 version has a couple of notable changes. For one, they replaced the green netlight track with just gray stones. Kind of boring, but definitely more easy on the eye. There are also more gliding sections and boost pads. I like gliding sections in general. It helps the track feel more modernized. I still think that this track is great and a good addition to the lineup. But compared to something like Ribbon Road, it's a bit dry visually. Then again, Ribbon Road in Mario Kart 8 may be the best looking track in the game, so it might not be the best comparison point. Last but certainly not least is Ninja Hideaway, also from Tor. While the other Tor tracks are based on real places, this track is set in a fictional ninja mansion. At least I think it's fictional, maybe this is a real place where all the Nintendo ninjas hang out. Ninja Hideaway is easily the most visually impressive and ambitious track in the update. It's filled with so much eye candy, it's a blink and you'll miss it type of track. I really like the Hanafuda design on the sliding panels. The course also has an incredible amount of optional paths and areas. Many of these paths are based on what floor you're on, so you can race down onto tummy mats or up in the rafters. Some of them can be pretty tricky to access since the course has a lot of moving parts. It's easy to botch or mistime a jump. Once you're out of the mansion proper, you'll finish the race by driving across roof tiles. It's an intense way to wrap up the track. Ninja Hideaway is definitely a course you need to try a few times to really understand all its intricacies. I'm not sure about the optimal path, but I always feel like the higher the better. It is quite difficult though. There are some very tight corners and a few ramps where the landing is unclear. Oftentimes you'll land nowhere and then Lakitu has to fetch you. It might take some practice to memorize, but there are some unforgiving spots that you don't see in most Mario Kart tracks. But overall, this is a course that definitely feels like a new Mario Kart 8 specific track. So my final ranking is Tokyo Blur, Ninja Hideaway, Coconut Mall, Choco Mountain, Sky Garden, Paris Promenade, Shroom Ridge, and then Toad Circuit. I'll say 5 great, 2 good, and 1 meh. That's not a bad deal though. I'm pleased with this first batch, and hey, we have 42 other tracks coming. So if you found it underwhelming, just wait and I'm sure they'll add your favorite course. Waluigi Pinball is coming. One thing I must note is that none of these tracks actually use anti-gravity, the main gimmick of Mario Kart 8. At least for now, these remixed tracks are closer to the original than other remixed courses. I'm not sure if this is just due to time, a design decision, or maybe they're planning to implement more anti-grav tracks in future updates. Maybe they simply just don't feel the need to have anti-grav sections in every track. I'm happy with the first wave. It's hard to say pay $25 just for these 8 tracks, or subscribe to the expansion pack solely for these tracks, but as the first big Mario Kart update in years, it's something to be excited about. The Booster Course Pass isn't the only notable NSO addition. A few weeks ago, Nintendo added F-Zero X to the N64 Nintendo Switch Online app. I don't like calling these things apps. It feels kind of icky. Nintendo is following a one-game-a-month schedule for N64 NSO. A lot of people don't like this system, but I can see the merit in it. It gives people time to play it and chat about it opposed to just dumping all the games out at once. I remember an old interview with someone who worked at Nintendo during the Wii days where they said the drip release schedule was absolutely more profitable than just shoving everything out at once. You gotta pay to use the service every month, so they need something, no matter how small, every 30 days to keep you paying. March gave us F-Zero X, the sequel to the SNES launch game F-Zero. It's pretty crazy that it took 8 years to develop a sequel to the original game. It was easily the most graphically impressive launch title for the Super Famicom, and you think it sold well enough. I mean, it had Mode 7, but like many SNES to N64 transitions, Nintendo really wanted to showcase it in a way to show the 3D processing power of their new hardware. The original game had a faux 3D look to it, so it wasn't some drastic reimagining, but Nintendo certainly got creative when it came to utilizing the 3D space of F-Zero X tracks. I barely played this game back in the N64 days. I may have just touched it for a few races at a friend's house. I actually do own it now, though. A Japanese copy with amazing box art. I got it for about 800 yen or so. Most of my Japanese N64 games have been under 10 bucks. It's probably one of the easier retro consoles to collect in Japan since it wasn't a big hit over here, so a lot of the games are pretty cheap. Also, there's only about 200 or so Japanese N64 titles, which is, you know, obtainable. Back to F-Zero X, let's talk about this game's star power. This game was produced by Miyamoto himself. It was directed by Tadashi Sugiyama, who has been with Nintendo since the Famicom days. He has a ton of notable credits to his name. He directed, or at least co-directed, Zelda 2, Super Mario Kart, Pilot Wings, and SNES SimCity. He also produced many other titles like Wii Fit. His last credit is on Tank Troopers from 2016. Not sure what he's doing these days, but he's still at Nintendo. He is definitely one of the many lifers at Nintendo whose names you might not know, but he's had a major hand in some of the most important games ever. Ironically, Sugiyama didn't work on the original F-Zero at all. F-Zero really doesn't have a face of the franchise, does it? I think that's a big reason why Nintendo really hasn't revisited it. There's likely not many at the company who consider F-Zero their passion project. I don't want to turn this segment into a what has happened to F-Zero sob story, but it's definitely important to look at the franchise in context. It was a graphical powerhouse for those first few games, but as Nintendo has moved away from graphical fidelity and having the most powerful hardware, franchises that rely on incredible visuals like F-Zero, Star Fox, and many sports games have been really low-priority franchises these days. In a long enough timeline, F-Zero will come back, but it's really hard to say when. F-Zero X is a very impressive sequel. It does the do-everything-bigger philosophy. More tracks, more cars, more modes, and these are not just small additions. They've gone full-blown exponential in terms of content. Do you know how many cars were in F-Zero? 4. F-Zero X? 30. That's nearly 10 times as much. Has another sequel given you 10 times as many playable characters? The tracks aren't boosted by that much, from 15 to 24, and many of these are remakes or remixes of the original courses. However, they certainly feel much different here, and Nintendo fully embraces the N64's 3D capabilities as opposed to the visual trickery of Mode 7. The game's most defining feature is arguably still ahead of its time, 60 frames per second. Yeah, it dips, but it's incredibly forward-thinking for a game in 1998, to prioritize frame rate over graphics, especially at a time when there was such a drastic difference in processing power between the consoles. The sense of speed was part of the original game's appeal, so it makes sense to prioritize that for the N64 title. It's pretty amazing how modern F-Zero X feels. The controls are snappy, and you're blasting through tracks at 60 frames per second. These are elements games even today hype up. You want that feeling of soaring down these courses at 1,000 miles per hour. The game actually does have a speedometer, and you often see it over 1,000 kilometers per hour. I don't think I've gone that fast in real life, so I can't really tell how accurate it is, but it's all about the feeling, the need for speed. Not only is it 60 FPS, but each race has 30 racers. To display 30 independent characters and still keep the 60 frames per second is incredibly impressive. Many programmers who worked on Wave Race 64 also contributed to this title, so they definitely brought in the big guns when it came to tech. But Nintendo had to make sacrifices to achieve this. It's no secret that F-Zero X isn't exactly a graphical powerhouse. The cars are very simplistic and blocky, with very limited detail. The tracks also don't have a lot of visual stimulation or extra details. It's got a lot of colors and a distinct art style, but a lot of the time you are just blazing across a flat gray tube. Compare it to Wave Race or Mario Kart 64, which conveys the sense that you are part of a fully realized world. F-Zero X doesn't concern itself with that. It just wants to go as fast as possible and is willing to sacrifice graphical fidelity to do so. You're the blue car, okay? You don't need all these other fancy touches on your vehicle. Even good graphics will eventually be dated, but 60 FPS will always be 60 FPS. The game has a specific vision and it executes it masterfully. Although the graphics lack detail, it's certainly very clean when you're racing. There's no visual clutter, it's obvious to tell the shape of the track and what elements are on the race course. There is definitely some pop-in, which is annoying when a boost pad magically shows up right next to you. I know a lot of people can't stand N64 graphics in general. Either the blockiness, the blurry textures, the fog. But this game might appeal to those people since it has a very minimalistic appearance. I will note that there has been slowdown every now and then, which isn't in the N64 version. It hasn't been that frequent for me, but I've seen some complaints. The N64 NSO app is definitely the rockiest. To Nintendo's credit, they have been fixing and improving issues, So it's not like they are just tossing it out there and never touching it again. Though you'd think they'd get it right the first time. N64 emulation is obviously harder than NES or SNES emulation, but people want to play these games with at least the quality of the original release. Let's get into the meat of the game, the races. The primary mode is the GP, where you race through 6 tracks vying for first place. Each race has 29 other racers, so you definitely need to get ahead of the pack if you want to cross the finish line first. Get first place and you'll unlock more tracks and more vehicles. I'll let you in on a secret though. There is absolutely a unlock everything cheat. I played a few cups without it, but yeah, why not just use the cheat? Cheat codes are a thing of the past, so it's almost refreshing to actually use one. I gotta pay for NSO every month. Just give me the goods. These races are quite intense and difficult. If you want to get first in a cup, you really can't slip up. It's very common for the same AI racer to get first or second every time if you don't, so you really need to be as perfect as possible. F-Zero is pretty well known for its difficulty, especially the GameCube version, and X certainly doesn't pull its punches. There are multiple difficulties, so you can knock it down to easy if you want. I might recommend you try this first, since you can get used to the mechanics and controls with less risk. Races are pretty straightforward. You drift, you boost, that's it. You can also ram other cars if you have some road rage in you. There's an energy bar that serves as both your boost bar and your health. So when you boost, you automatically deplete your health. You need to be careful about this, as a bad turn or aggressive AI can end the race for you instantly if you've been jamming on that boost button. There are also boost pads that give you free boosts, which help more aggressive players. This sort of back and forth between depleting and filling up your health makes each lap really exciting. Do you push your luck at the risk of possibly blowing up? You need to get ahead early and keep widening your lead. It's not like Mario Kart where anything could change at any moment, so you'll be boosting a lot. Speed is more important than health. There are healing areas in every track, and honestly, I think there's maybe too many of them. You can easily fill up your health to full each lap. I think it would be more exciting if the health areas were more rare, or at least spread out more evenly throughout the course, instead of one designated area. Although the tracks have similar looks, many of them are completely different in their design. Nintendo fully focuses on making the courses feel 3D. You do loop-de-loops, spin under the track. It definitely feels much different from the SNES tracks. It's pretty funny to think about how much F-Zero DNA is in Mario Kart 8. I mean, they shoved F-Zero tracks into that game. Worth noting that F-Zero X does have a Rainbow Road course, which is pretty awesome. Other awesome courses, I like Sand Ocean, and Big Hand is a track shaped like a hand. It's incredibly difficult, and you really need to be a drift king to even survive a single lap. But it's exciting to try and master. Outside of the cup races, there is a time attack and a death race mode. The death race is actually kind of like a battle royale, where you race until the other racers have been destroyed. This sounds amazing on paper, but the execution isn't that great. For one, it's only a single, very basic track, where you basically just go straight. Also, the AI doesn't attempt to fight the other racers. It's really just up to you to KO everyone by ramming your car into theirs. It's kind of an interesting diversion, but you really only need to do it once, and I doubt you'll try it again. Worth noting that F-Zero X actually had an add-on via the ill-fated N64 disk drive, the F-Zero X expansion kit. It came with more music, more tracks, and most importantly, a track editor. You can make your own F-Zero tracks. There was also a car editor, so you can make your own blocky racer. Sadly, none of these features are included in the NSO version of F-Zero X. It was never translated into English, so that's likely the reason why, but I'm hoping we get some disk drive content on the service eventually. That stuff has never been re-released or made available in any tangible way. Plus, it's pretty expensive to pick up today. I've seen the expansion kit at over $100, and that's in Japan where retro game prices are the cheapest. F-Zero X is kind of the strange middle child of the console F-Zeros. It is not as mind-blowing in the graphical showcase the original title was, and it doesn't have the intensity and speed of GX, or AX, the arcade version, which is definitely worth playing if you find it in Japan. That said, I do think F-Zero X is certainly much better than its SNES counterpart. There's more content and the controls feel tighter, which is basically what you want in a sequel. GX AX overall is better though, but that game benefited from much stronger tech. If you've never played F-Zero X and have the NSO expansion pack, give it a shot. I think you'll be surprised by how well it holds up. And even if you're bad at the game, it's got a great soundtrack, so just sit at 30th place and listen to some great tunes. Mario Kart? Iconic. F-Zero? Not as successful, but still beloved. Stunt Race FX? That's a different question. If you've never heard of this game, it's a 1994 SNES racing game. It's on NSO right now, so you can play it on modern hardware. There are people who certainly herald this game as an incredible showcase of the SNES hardware, but it's pretty ignored even among hardcore Nintendo fans. Stunt Race FX, also known as Wild Tracks in Japan. I'm not quite sure which is a better title there. Maybe the English name is more accurate? You do stunts, you race? Honestly, the tracks aren't that wild, so I'll give it to the English name. The game, oddly enough, has a very notable pedigree despite it being largely ignored over the years. It's developed by EAD proper, and Miyamoto is a producer, with assistance from Argonaut Software. Now, Argonaut are the key people behind the development of the Super FX chip, which created 3D graphics and environments on the SNES. They made Star Fox, okay? I think I can sum them up just with that. The game launched just a year after Star Fox blew minds with its graphics, and it very much feels like Nintendo wanted to evoke the same feeling with Stunt Race FX. Off the top of your head, how many Super FX games were there? The answer is technically 8. Games developed by Nintendo? Only 3. Star Fox, Stunt Race FX, and Yoshi's Island. So this game is definitely the outlier of that batch. Since the N64 was already in development soon after the launch of the Super FX chip, it didn't actually get a whole lot of use, despite it producing incredibly impressive visuals at the time. The SNES version of Doom also uses the Super FX chip, so that's something. I guess you could consider Stunt Race FX the sort of spiritual successor to Star Fox in a way. It's made by a lot of the same people, and it uses the same tech. The game has you navigate more actual 3D environments than Star Fox, however. The bulk of the game is racing on a track with a perspective similar to Mario Kart and F-Zero. The tracks do convey a strong sense of being in 3D. You often go up and down curves. It doesn't feel flat like, say, Super Mario Kart. The vehicles are also not just mere sprites. They look like fully rendered 3D models where you can actually see every aspect of the car. In Super Mario Kart and F-Zero for SNES, it does kind of look like your racer is kind of slapped onto the game. Mario Kart 64 also looks like this, since the racers are mere sprites. But in Stunt Race FX, the cars visually feel part of the world. Now, the standout aspect of Stunt Race FX is definitely the graphics. Vehicles and tracks are 3D, and it's impressive compared to many other 1994 titles. Compared to Star Fox, it certainly feels like a huge step up in terms of displaying 3D polygons on the SNES. A lot of things in Star Fox are just, here's a cube, here's a pyramid. In Star Fox, I often thought, what are you supposed to be? Are you a face shooting checks at me? Since Stunt Race FX uses more realistic reference points, it helps in keeping the game visually coherent. These graphics are quaint now, but I would have had my mind blown in 1994 if I played it then. Though ironically, compared to other 1994 SNES titles like Chrono Trigger or Donkey Kong Country, it's not as visually appealing. Art style is always better than graphics. The first thing you'll likely notice after the fact that, whoa, this game is 3D, is the frame rate, or lack thereof. This is not 60 frames per second, I'll tell you that much. It's much closer to, say, 15 frames per second. This can be incredibly jarring, and I think this will turn a lot of people off. It looks so choppy, but the game is sort of designed around the low frame rate, if that makes any sense. The cars are purposefully lumbering. It doesn't rely on tight reflexes or millisecond thinking, but instead planning out your turns and managing your brakes and acceleration. I think if this game tried to be F-Zero and ran at the frame rate it does, it would be incredibly awful. But since the game is sort of designed around being slower and more quote-unquote realistic, it's not bad once you get used to it. I believe too many people will think this is unplayable once they boot it up, but once you get a feel for controlling the cars and navigating the tracks, the game actually is more solid than one would expect. As a racing game, it certainly feels more grounded than Mario Kart or F-Zero. Yeah, your cars have eyes, and they may be alive, but the racing is very straightforward. You drive normal vehicles, you don't have any weapons, you aren't racing on any gravity-defying tracks or through volcanoes. Yeah, there are more fantastical courses like racing in the sky, but many are just asphalt tracks in cities. The tracks don't have any wacky obstacles. I do have to mention that there are occasional billboards of the Nintendo logo and of Nintendo characters. Mario, Fox, and yes, even Kirby pop up here. It's pretty funny to see how quickly Kirby became part of the Nintendo family. This game was just 2 years after Dream Land, but they're putting him right up there next to Mario. I wonder if this checks some sort of trivia box as the first game to feature Mario, Fox, and Kirby together. Is Stunt Race FX the proto Smash Brothers? There are Stunt Race FX spirits in Smash, so maybe Sakurai is trying to tell us something. The cars are also less wild, But again, keep in mind that they do have eyes and may be sentient. There's a monster truck, a regular car, a F1 racer, and you can unlock a two-wheeled vehicle that is not quite a car, but not quite a bike. These cars have different stats for speed and handling, typical things you'd expect in a racing game. I personally prefer the standard car. It's the most boring pick, but also the easiest to control. The game defaults on the monster truck, which is actually quite a difficult car to use, so that decision is pretty odd. The races are your standard 3-lap, get first place type of affair. There are only 3 other racers on the track, so it's definitely a far cry from F-Zero X and its dozens of rivals. The races have what I would call an outrun-style system, where you need to clear each checkpoint within a certain time. You pass a checkpoint and you might have only 40 seconds to get to the next one, or else you'll automatically lose. This is a strange feature to put into the game. Maybe it's there to serve as more of a mercy rule, but it's an unnecessary challenge. I mean, you're trying to get first place. You don't need any other type of interference. Your car could also get destroyed through damage from other racers or cars crashing into walls. You can refill your health and gain boost power via power-ups on the tracks. Unlike F-Zero, though, your health and boost power are entirely independent, and there are no boost pads on the actual tracks. Your time on the asphalt is centered around making sure you nail those turns. If you crash into a wall, it's a pretty huge setback considering the controls. In Mario Kart or F-Zero, you can really just bump your way back onto the track. Here, it's very easy for your car to just get stuck or completely turn backwards. And backing up is a pain. It's almost better to just rewind because getting out of that jam is going to take some time. The races are pretty basic compared to Nintendo's other racers, but that almost helps it stand out in a way. It doesn't feel like MK or F-Zero at all. Most people will say, yeah, and those games are way better. I mean, they aren't wrong. People typically want the feeling of speed in their racing games, which Stunt Race FX doesn't have. It's much slower, maybe even more methodical. Now, we've talked about the race part, but what about these stunts? There is a completely separate Stunt Tracks mode, where you don't race against other drivers, and instead collect 40 stars in a 3D arena. Here you have much more obstacles like road bumps, ramps, and other things to hurl your car off of. It's much more open, but you'll also need to progress through checkpoints to get more time on the clock. So ideally, you'll want to get all the stars in an area, then hit the checkpoint to be brought to a new section. These tracks are much better at conveying the fact that this game is 3D. It also suits the slower paced and clunkier controls of the cars. You're not trying to get first place here, but instead trying to navigate a space. There are only 4 tracks compared to the dozen or so in the race mode, but it kind of makes me wonder if this should have been the actual focus of the game instead of the racing. As a racing game, it's serviceable and an interesting comparison point, but driving around a more open 3D space with a car is a more unique idea, right? I'm about 28 years too slow with this hot take, but focusing more on the stunt instead of the race part of the title would have made for at least a more distinctive game, but perhaps that is too niche. And apparently this game did sell quite well, so I guess I'm wrong. Yet, even though this game may have sold well, it never got a sequel. There is a canceled one for the N64, but Stunt Race FX never saw the light of day again until Nintendo Switch Online. It was never even on the Virtual Console, which is incredibly strange to me. No Wii, no Wii U, no 3DS. This is an EAD-developed, Nintendo-published title. Why was it so ignored by Nintendo? Why is it even ignored by hardcore Nintendo fans? Obviously, comparing it to Mario Kart or F-Zero, it's much more simplistic and significantly slower. And since the N64 came out just a few years later, the 3D graphics aren't as impressive. But I think there's fun to be had here. I could see people in 1994 eating it up, and even playing it for the first time today makes you appreciate some of the technical wizardry they pulled off with this game. I would recommend at least going through the first cup to see what this game has to offer. Alright, we can lift our foot off the pedal for now. Let's move on to the news. A couple of things to talk about this episode. Like I mentioned earlier, this is being recorded much more ahead of time than normal. So if anything dropped these past few days, well, companies should really plan around this podcast. We've been pretty NSO heavy this episode, so let's lead with that. 3 new Genesis/Mega Drive titles are now available. Alien Soldier, Super Fantasy Zone, and Light Crusader. These are fairly obscure, but have an amazing pedigree. I think a lot of people already know about Fantasy Zone. It's a pretty classic Sega shmup. It has one of my favorite looking ships in any shmup. It's so simple, but you can easily tell what it is. Half the time in shmups, your ship is just some sort of X-Wing knockoff or some sort of nondescript spaceship. But Fantasy Zone, That design will stick in your brain forever. Alien Soldier and Light Crusader are treasure titles who worked on Sin and Punishment, Gunstar Heroes, Bungo, and many other fast-paced action titles. I've actually never touched these two games before. Alien Soldier was released exclusively through Sega Channel in the States, so I doubt many played it back in 1995. It's a side-scrolling action game, but Light Crusader is isometric. It definitely reminds me of Landstalker, but it is more action-oriented than that game. Both these treasure games are highly regarded, so I'll try to spend some time with both of them. Please, release Bungo on Switch somehow. N64, Dreamcast, whatever. Pokemon Brilliant Diamond and Shining Pearl, again. I wonder if this is the most referenced game on this podcast, because it often seems like I have something to say about it. PDSP got an update, adding in both Darkrai and Arceus, and not just the Pokemon. Like with Shaymin, the actual events are implemented into the game. You get the member card, you get the Azure Flute. This is the second time this year we got the Azure Flute, despite going 15 years with it being unobtainable. I still think it's great that we are getting the actual events replicated, instead of just them mystery gifting us these mythical Pokemon. These are time limited, so if you want to get them, get on it. Also, after 3,000 years, we finally have access to the Global Wonder Station, which replaced the Global Trade Station from the original game. It unlocks the Wonder Trade feature, where you can put up a Pokemon and randomly get one back. It also keeps track of where these Pokemon come from, so if you get a Wonder Trade from someone in Antarctica, you'll know it. Go ahead and collect all the countries, that's the real metagame. Still no home update though. It's been nearly 6 months and we still don't have support for a service we pay for. I honestly don't know what they're waiting for. We got all the mythical Pokemon now, open up home please. I'm not sure what else they could add to BDSP, it seems like support is probably winding down. I enjoyed my time with BDSP, but it also got a lot of criticism for being a very safe, unambitious remake of one of the best Pokemon games. We got Arceus though, which you could consider the real Gen 4 remake. BDSP and Arceus are certainly really fascinating companion pieces. Kirby's 30th anniversary is this year, so what better time to host a concert? A Kirby 30th anniversary concert will be held August 11th in Tokyo. Odaiba specifically, which is famous for its event halls and shopping areas. I was interested in going, but it's during the afternoon on a weekday, so it's not exactly something I can get to easily. If you are going to go to this concert, please, please, please contact me, and I'll put you on the podcast and you can talk all about it. But the good thing is, it will be live streamed worldwide. It'll eventually be posted on Nintendo's YouTube channel as well. Strangely, the video will be delisted in March 2023 because, who knows? The Kirby franchise has amazing music, and there are many CDs and soundtracks of Kirby remixes and renditions in Japan. So I'm interested to see what new arrangements they have for this concert. It'll be a few months after the Forgotten Land, so we should expect some tunes from that game. I'm really looking forward to it. This is kind of old news, but Nintendo has implemented Nintendo Switch Online missions and rewards. This lets you unlock new icons to use for your Nintendo Switch profile. Icons, avatars, whatever you want to call it. You can choose new characters, backgrounds, and frames. Currently, only Super Mario Odyssey and Animal Crossing New Horizons are supported, but I'm sure they'll add more in the future. They're also rotating out the avatars, weekly for Mario and monthly for Animal Crossing. You can choose all the animals with a March birthday as your profile icon, which is a pretty fun idea. Now, you get these avatars via Platinum Points, which you can earn through special missions like play a game online or play Super Mario Brothers on NSO. Honestly, most people will likely have hundreds of Platinum Coins just by regularly using your Switch, so the missions aren't that exciting. Now, if they gave out Gold Coins, I'd be more hyped. This is kind of a strange thing to add to the Switch, but hey, we could always use more avatars. They are prominently displayed in a lot of online Nintendo titles, so having more diversity would be nice. I'm hoping we get some unrepresented series in here, though. We have no Fire Emblem icons, no Pokemon icons. I know these are co-owned by other companies, but hey, we got Kirby. Let's not be stingy now. If I had to pick one character to add, it would obviously be Diskun, the Famicom Disk System mascot. It's always interesting to see what value Nintendo keeps adding to Nintendo Switch Online. This is a very unconventional thing, but it's a very Nintendo-style update. Elden Ring. Remember Elden Ring? I'm still slowly trucking through it. My opinion hasn't changed much. It's a great game. Nerve-wracking, but great. And a lot of people agree with me, as it has sold 12 million copies since launch, according to Bandai Namco. This is notably more than Dark Souls 3, which sold 10 million over the course of several years. I know a lot of people were hyped for this game, but I never expected it to hit this number so quickly. the unanimous praise and open world structure has really hooked people who normally don't touch From Software titles. I expect it to have strong legs too. It'll be a game that people jump into years from now, like Skyrim or Breath of the Wild. I have to think it'll reach 20 million at least. It makes me curious as to what From's next project will be. I think Elden Ring DLC is likely. I can imagine Namco on the phone yelling at From to make more Elden Ring. But anyway, anyhow, From pretty much has a blank check for their next title. Honestly, it doesn't need to be Elden Ring 2. I can see them wanting to try something at least a bit different, like they did with Sekiro. I imagine it will be a Souls cousin, though. Though if From said, we want to make Cookie and Cream again, Namco would pony up that cash. I wonder if From would ever be interested in tackling an established franchise, but they don't really need to unless Miyazaki has a strong idea. No matter what From does next, I think the more interesting idea is what everyone else will do next. Elden Ring proves there is a huge audience for Souls games, and like Breath of the Wild, it raises the bar for open world games. Is Ubisoft going to say, we're going to make our Elden Ring? Are developers who are planning out their next open world game going to use Elden Ring as their main inspiration? Are we just going to get even more Souls-like games from major publishers? I wouldn't be surprised if Koei Tecmo tried an open world Neo game now. I loved Neo 1. It has my favorite combat of any Souls-related game. The art style and Japanese setting was also really appealing to me. The games are structured completely differently from a typical Souls game, though, so to shift so hard and bring the series to the open world genre would be quite the leap. Though when Breath of the Wild 2 comes out, are people going to think, no wait, forget Elden Ring, Breath of the Wild 2 actually captures what we want from an open world game? I think there will always be a niche for the checklist open world games, your Assassin's Creed, your Far Cries, Horizon, Ghost of Tsushima. But a lot of people are definitely burnt out of this type of game. Many AAA open world games took a lot of inspiration from The Witcher 3 and Red Dead 2, with its emphasis on story, detailed questlines, and interactions with NPCs. But I think after Breath of the Wild and now Elden Ring, there will be a harder shift towards more mysterious, minimalistic storytelling in open worlds that are more handcrafted. Yuka Mori, a clay sculpture artist perhaps best known for her Pokemon card designs, is having an exhibition in Tokyo called 47 Japanese Folk Monsters starting from April 27th. It will feature clay designs of yokai across Japan. This sort of has nothing to do with video games, but Mori is an amazing artist and her Pokemon card art is so unique. She's been contributing to the Pokemon TCG since Gen 2 and still puts out new cards today. The new Time Gazer and Space Juggler set will also feature some of her art. Seriously, if you've never seen her card art, look it up. The clay Pokemon sculptures kind of give it an early 3D look, but they fit in perfectly with the realistic backgrounds. I'll probably go to the exhibit, so I'll report back. Now for Japanese software and hardware sales. Pokemon Legends Arceus has reclaimed the number one spot and sits at 2.1 million physically. We haven't gotten any updated numbers since that 6.5 million figure a few days after launch, but I think it will have healthy legs at least until Gen 9. And maybe even after, depending how different those two games are. Elden Ring dropped, but it has sold 385,000 units on PS4 and PS5 physically. Namco did put out the number that Elden Ring has sold 1 million in Japan, but this may just be sell-through and not actual copies sold. It's a bit hard to imagine 600K are from digital and Steam sales, but it's not impossible. A huge chunk of Elden Ring sales is from PC, and the market does exist in Japan. They sell Steam cards at convenience stores. Chocobo GP debuted at 12K, which is very low and I doubt it's going to be a breakout hit considering the word of mouth. I don't know why developers look at Mario Kart, a game with a ton of characters and tracks, and think, let's just chop it up and sell it to people piece by piece. No, the appeal of kart racers is that you can pick up and play them. It doesn't need to be some sort of live service game with season passes and 4 currencies. It's so simple. Get in the car and go vroom. Switch hardware is at 98K this week, up from 96K last week. The same week last year, it was 72K, so Switch is performing very strong early on in the year. Kirby is a big Q1 title, and I imagine that it will move some hardware. PS5 is at 16K, down from last week's 25K. This time last year, it was at 37,000 units, so I'm not quite sure what to say here. I could say stock issues all day long, but there is a trend of PlayStation slice of the Japanese gaming pie getting smaller and smaller as Nintendo continues to dominate. Elden Ring is a huge breakout hit, so that might help move some hardware, but as long as there are big multi-platform games, people will be hesitant to jump to the PS5. Let's start wrapping it up with the Japanese gaming phrase of the week. This episode's phrase is emo. Emo. It literally means potato. It refers to someone on your team or a player who kind of doesn't do anything. They barely contribute to your team and rarely attack or do anything of note. Instead of a person on your team, a potato is on your team. This is not a gaming-only term. You can also use it in everyday life slang, but it seems somewhat prevalent in gaming communities. So if you play online, don't be a potato. Don't be an emo. One more time, emo. Now for the Japanese tweet of the week. I've chosen one from @BlackTangent, a Mario collector. This tweet shows off a gold medal from a Mario Kart Double Dash competition. The tweet doesn't explain what the competition was or where it was held, but it's definitely a gold Double Dash themed medal. It comes in a box labeled Hot Mario, which was a Japanese ad campaign in the early 2000s. There was also a special Famicom-themed GBA SP created for this ad campaign. One of the many unusual Japanese Nintendo ad campaigns. Hey, now that would be a good feature. Tweet is in the description as always. Time's up. A breezier episode this time around. I mean, it's racing themed, so why wouldn't it blow by? Thanks as always for listening. Be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite app. This podcast is also available on YouTube, so like and subscribe there as well. I'm on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. Just search for Tokyo Game Life or find the links in the podcast description. If you like the podcast, be sure to share it with your friends. If there's anything you want me to talk about or cover, don't be shy. Just hit me up on social media. The next episode will be on Sunday, April 10th. It'll be all Kirby, so get those pink shirts ready. See you next time. Mata ne!